So I'm not pulling out of the driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for the Drive to Work Coronavirus Edition. Okay, so I've been doing fun interviews. That continues. I today have Mike Turian.
Hey, Mark. It's good to not be in your car.
Yes. Well, you join me on my drive to work. Man, this used to mean something. Now it's sitting in my den. Okay, so I'll start with a question I've been asking everybody. How did you get into Magic?
Okay, so I started playing Magic. The first pack of Magic that I purchased was The Dark. So a couple of years ago now.
Yeah.
And the way it sort of happened was, originally I had heard about Magic through, I was in high school at the time, and, you know, in English class, sort of in the back of the room, these guys, they were playing this card game. I didn't really know what it was, but, you know, it looked fun, it looked interesting, and they actually taught me to play when we were at sort of this overnight camp. And, you know, I kind of treated it as like any other sort of board game of like, hey, that was a fun evening activity. But then my mom sent me to a different leadership training program. I remember the name SLAP very well. It was like student leadership something something. And and which I, me and my high school friends, of course, had fun times with. And at that activity, my friend Ari Stuhlman, every day, it was a week-long program, and on Monday, he's like, hey, you got to come check out this game. And on Tuesday, he said it again. And finally, when he asked me for the third time on Wednesday, I was like, all right, fine. Like, I could tell he was just going to ask me on Thursday and Friday, too, right? So it was just easier to go along. We went down to the card store, and lo and behold, it was that same card game that that I'd been playing, you know, a few months prior. Now, I really wish I had sort of picked it up a few months prior, right, and just gotten in even more at the ground floor, of course. But, yeah, we bought some Dark. We started playing with Revised, and, you know, I remember opening it up, and it totally blew my mind. Just at the time, it was so unlike any other game I'd ever played. You know, the fact that you could customize the components as you went was such a novel and fun idea for me that I fell in love. And, you know, here we are 25 plus years later. And, you know, I was playing Jumpstart on Magic Arena last night. So I clearly still love it.
Okay, so how old were you when you started?
Man, it was between my freshman and sophomore years of high school. So I think that means I was either 13 or 14. You know, I must have been, I'm going to say 14 but it's a long time ago. That's what I really remember.
Okay. So did you play continually since then? Like up till, we'll get to your Wizards days. Did you play continually or did you stop for a while?
No, I was really hooked. I played in my first event, you know, so if I started playing, I'll say in like August or September, right, if I recall, is about when The Dark came out. I played in my first event in November, and I came in second place. It was like an 80-person event, and I really loved the tournament scene. I mean, eventually I would go on to play in Pro Tours and whatnot. But the tournaments and that the constant events really always kept me engaged, right? So even if there was, you know, a month or two where, you know, I was focusing on other things, I would still be playing Magic, you know, and traveling to events, even at basically all the time. The only sets for me that I really don't have as much experience with are actually when I joined Wizards later on. Like, you know, you have that sort of gap in time as we work on sets ahead of time.
Right.
So there were a couple of sets in the Champions, in the Kamigawa block, that I just had a lot less experience with because of jumping ahead in time. But no, I mean, I've played weekly, daily, monthly, you know, ever since I've started playing.
Okay, so we only had a half an hour, and you've worked at Wizards a long time. So you played on the Pro Tour, you did really well, you made the Hall of Fame. We're not even going to get into that. That could be its own podcast. But you obviously had a lot of success. So how did you get to Wizards?
Okay, so yes, that sort of I like how we consolidated my Hall of Fame magic career into a small sound bit.
15 seconds. You did a lot. You made the Hall of Fame. Boom. Moving on.
Boom. Yeah. It's a lot of played flights here and there and everywhere. So through the course of that, I was fortunate enough to meet Randy Buehler and become teammates with Randy during that whole Hall of Fame pro tour career time. And Randy would go on, you know, and join Magic R&D. And at the time, he was the director of Magic R&D. And so he basically, you know, every fall, they'd be looking for new interns or new contractors to join. And, you know, Randy, as the director of Magic R&D, had full hiring power. And so basically my interview with Randy was because they were looking for, you know, play designers, like people who could really play test and assess the power level of cards. So I drove out to Seattle after graduating from the University of Pittsburgh, and I was just crashing on a friend's couch, basically knowing that, hey, this contract opportunity would be coming up again. And so my interview process was actually Randy invited me out to lunch at a Mexican restaurant, and I had my interview for the contract position over the lunch. And basically Randy was like, look, you know, you're here. There's no one I would rather have join Magic R&D in this role. And so that was my interview. Right. And it was so great that, of course, the Pro Tour meant that, you know, I'd already met, you know, people like you, Mark. So I was already kind of known within Magic R&D. So there was just a little less of that typical formality of interviews. So yeah, that was really it. I went to a Mexican restaurant for lunch, and I started a couple weeks later in Magic R&D.
What was the first thing you worked on?
The first set I was on was Guild Pact, as that I was actually on the team for. I did playtesting for Ravnica. You know, Saviors of Kamigawa was basically totally done by the time that I had showed up. So, like, I was playing FFL with those cards, but they were complete. So that sort of gives you the time frame. Also, I think Cold Snap team sort of fired up around that time, so I was on the Cold Snap team as well. Yeah, it was many years ago. I remember I had a book of that had all the magic cards in it, right? All the magic images in it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think Gather even existed back when I started. I'd have to double check. But I remember at the time looking at that and then sort of being like, okay, this is all of magic that has existed before I started working on magic, right? And now, you know, the amount of cards we've put out, like, would way overwhelm that. So I'm super proud of all the work that, you know, we've done making so many fun cards.
Okay, so the first set you led, that you're on the development lead, was Scars of Mirrodin, correct?
Well, Scars of Mirrodin was the first large set that I...
What did you lead before Scars of Mirrodin?
So the first set I was the lead for, I believe, was Future Sight.
Oh, right? Future Sight, okay.
Right, yeah. So the sets I led as a developer, or final designer, as we now call them, Scars of Mirrodin, Worldwake, Conflux, Morning Tide, Future Sight. So imagine being, you know, I mean, I've worked now in R&D for a couple of years by the time this all came up. But then Future Sight was the...
I think I had the list backwards. So Future Sight's your first set. So that was a challenging first set to lead the development on.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something else. Like, hey, we're going to show all of these crazy mechanics, and we want to be predicting the future of magic. And, you know, so that was... And, of course, you know, as you've told many times before, it was a set where we initially were planning on introducing Planeswalkers... Right. So all of this was we were looking to jam into, I believe, 180 card set.
Yeah. The story I often tell is we do something called hole filling, where we give out stuff for people to make cards. And so for Future Sight, we had the future shift of cards with the cards from the future. And you did a hole filling and you came to me and you go, none of it works, Mark. I need you to make me cards. Make me some future cards.
Right. Yeah. No. That's totally that I think really encapsulates how Future Sight went as a design, because it's just so out of the box, right? Yeah. Like, it's outside of the box. And working on that, it just, you know, I was really glad to be able to tap into your insight and designs there, because you just need to really have a really strong fundamental understanding of what matters in design to sort of understand what the future could even be, right? And to project that.
Yeah, so that was, like I said, that was a challenging first set. So that's the first set you led. The second set you led was Morning Tide, which was in the Lorman block. And that was, I had the brilliant idea of having the first set be a race tribal set and the second set being a class tribal set. So how did that go?
there were definitely different challenges with Morning Tide than there were with Future Sight, right? Future Sight had I remember really distinctly looking at this grid, because I think Lorwyn had like eight races, and then Morning Tide had five classes, right? And so, like, you know, and of course then there's
real quickly, just because I want to explain to the audience, a race would be like goblin or elf, and a class would be like warrior or wizard. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Right, and so then there were, right, there were the classes, there were the races, and then basically, and then you overlay the colors, and you end up with this, like, huge matrix of things. And so putting that together, you know, it just, there were pluses, there were minuses. I certainly felt for players when, you know, they were experiencing that matrix through gameplay, because, you know, it was just a little bit too much to care about.
Yeah, that set directly led to New World Order getting created.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because, right, I mean, when you're talking about matrix, like, that is a mathematical thing. When you're talking about playing Magic and having fun, it's like, of course, math matters for Magic. But yeah, the fun is really where you want to be focusing things. And so, yeah, New World Order came about around that time also, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the theme so far I see is you just get very complicated sets to work on.
Yeah, there's definitely, well, because, I mean, at the time, and I think that, you know, to New World Order's credit, it sort of reset how Magic R&D thought about it, right? A lot of our innovation was coming through complexity, and so, you know, with New World Order, with the reintroduction of the core set, you know, we sort of said, hey, let's step back. Let's hit on more resonance. Let's hit on these tropes and these themes that make Magic so much fun. And you can sort of see that now in all of our newer design sets.
Okay, so the next set you led was Conflux.
Yeah, so Conflux was really fun, you know, because one of the things to me about Conflux was it was all about Nicol Bolas, right? And, you know, it was one of the sets that had only that single Planeswalker in the set, and...
Well, should we explain this real quickly? So when Planeswalkers got introduced in Lorwyn, the plan at the time was it'd be a sporadic thing that every once in a while we do. Not every set would have Planeswalkers was the idea originally. And so, yeah, your set, right, the only Planeswalker I think in Conflux was Nicol Bolas.
Yeah, Nicol Bolas was the only one, and... You're right. Like now, typically a set will have around three Planeswalkers in it, right? You know, three to five, but yeah. So for Conflux, it was like, hey, okay, we're doing another Planeswalker, and I remember you being like, you know, basically saying, hey, the Nicol Bolas that we have just isn't cutting it, and you know, you sat down one day and you sent me, you know, this whole pages of designs, because basically you were like, look, you know, it's Nicol Bolas. It needs to be awesome. And it was exactly what the set needed. I was super happy with how Nicol Bolas came out in that set. And also I remember, too, just a fun little aside, that I believe that somehow the names of the Conflux cards were shown ahead of time, you know, were leaked or whatnot. And... But none of the mechanics. And so I remember the internet's excitement over seeing Nicol Bolas Planeswalker, but just, and then having no idea what he did and speculating. So it really, to me, that sort of focus on Nicol Bolas, was one of the things I was happy with how Conflux came out.
Okay, so after Conflux, you next did Worldwake. So Conflux was the second set in Shards of Alara block. Next set you did was Worldwake, which was the second set in Zendikar block.
Yeah, Zendikar. Yeah, so I'm sure you've told the audience about sort of your fights with Landfall in getting Landfall made, but
I gave you props here. So the story I tell with Zendikar people know is that no one believed in the Lands Matter set, but one person did believe, and that was you, Mike Turian. You were the only person that believed. So I want to give you props.
Thank you. Yes, I did believe in you, Mark. I think that, you know, in retrospect, it sounds so obvious. It's like, of course Lands Matter. Of course that'll be awesome. But at the time, yeah, people really, really gave you a lot of hard time and a lot of grief about, like, how can Lands possibly matter? So anyhow, so as part of that, you know, because I worked on the Zendikar team, and then I was leading Worldwake. And Worldwake is another set that's, you know, Jace the Mind Sculptor was the only Planeswalker in the set. And once again, it's like, all right, how are we going to make Jace awesome? You know, what is this super awesome Planeswalker who's, you know, in the Gatewatch and this and that?
This is pre-Gatewatch.
It was pre-Gatewatch at the time, but just, you know.
Jace was one of our most famous and popular Planeswalkers.
Yes. And we knew that, and he was one of the most beloved of the original Lorwyn 5. And so, all right, we want to make Worldwake awesome. We want to make Jace awesome. And then, of course, everything around Land Matters and... you know, so it was a really fun set to work on, and you know, of the sets that we're talking about, it's sort of, I don't know, it has a special place in my heart for sure.
If only you made Jace the Mind Sculptor good.
It turns out, yeah, I always could used to be, I made the most powerful Planeswalker of all time. Now perhaps Oko is sort of in competition for that, but. Yeah, Jace, he turned out really powerful. I mean, and we wanted him to. You know, we were looking to sort of brand build and awareness build around Jace and around Planeswalkers. You know, I probably would have gone back and done it slightly differently given learnings of the past, but he certainly did come out powerful.
Yeah, quick story behind that, just so people don't know. When we originally made Planeswalkers and they made the frames for Planeswalkers, I said to them, design a 3 loyalty Planeswalker and design a 4 loyalty. We're going to do a 4 loyalty, so design the frame. And I know when I came to you when we were doing this, and I said, it's time for the 4. So the one thing we gave you from design, you designed the card, but we said it has 4 loyalty abilities. That's the one thing we knew about it from design, that we had planned the frame from the beginning.
Right, yeah, we knew for sure, yes. When it was handed off to me, it was... mostly a blank slate, and also this is going to have 4 abilities and sort of vision principles around how we thought the how those 4 abilities would work together, right? We knew we wanted an ultimate, and then, all right, what are these other 3 abilities going to work? And also, of course, since we're putting words on the card, those abilities both need to be cool and awesome and fit on a card.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something people don't think a lot about that we think all the time, but like logistics. Like, that's awesome. It doesn't fit on the card. Redo it.
Right. Okay. For sure.
Okay, next up is, I think, the last set you led the development for before you've had many jobs at Wizards. We'll talk about that in a second. So, Skarz Mirrodin.
Yeah, Skarz Mirrodin. Mirrodin, the original Mirrodin was one of my all-time favorite Magic sets, right, at the time I was working on Skarz Mirrodin. You know, I had a lot of success on the Pro Tour playing the set. I always really enjoyed equipment and the introduction of equipment. And so now it was that blending of Mirrodin with the introduction of Phyrexia, right? And, you know, one of the things to me that will always stick out about Skarz of Mirrodin was bringing Poison back to Magic. I mean, you know, been part of Magic, of course. But really, Skarz of Mirrodin with Infect, and how we're going to bring this poison mechanic back and do it in a new, fun way. So a lot of Skarz of Mirrodin was both that the Mirrodin representing doing equipment, which, of course, we had some power level challenges with prior, and then doing, in fact, in the right way.
Yeah, the other thing, a little behind the scenes thing, is I tried to bring Affinity back, but R&D decided it was a little too risky, so we didn't end up doing it, but I tried.
Yeah, I remember between the reintroduction of Poison and wanting Affinity to return, that I had a lot of conversations with a lot of internal people around, okay, is this possible? Is that possible? Because both of the mechanics were, you know, controversial for very different reasons.
Okay, so now, so the next, I'm gonna do what I did with your Pro Tour career, with your middle of Magic career, middle of Wizards career. So you left R&D to go work in various other sections of the company. Where all did you work? You worked?
Yes. So I went from R&D. I went over to Organized Play and worked on the Organized Play team for a couple years. Then that brought me down to the technology team, and I worked as a producer for the technology team. Eventually, that would lead me to become product manager for Magic Online, and then business and marketing manager for Magic Duels. And then I came back to Magic R&D a few years ago as a principal product designer.
Okay, so let's explain what that is, since you and I have some idea, but the audience does not. What is a principal product designer? What do you do?
So, principal product designer, if you think of the vision designer as sort of that initial, like, your role of, hey, what is the vision of the set? And spending time and being like, okay, what matters for, you know, say Throne of Eldraine.
Yeah, Throne of Eldraine. Right? Let's start with Throne of Eldraine. That's a good example.
Yeah. So, okay, Throne of Eldraine. Oh, how much of it is storybook? How much of it is fantasy? How much of it is fairy tale, right? And the vision designer spends a lot of time both figuring out what that vision is and then building the structure and outline around the vision. So in my role, one of the big things I do is then I'm one of the people that carry the vision, you know, through game design. I work with the final designers to basically make sure that there's connections there. But then throughout the whole company, right? I mean, I know that we spend a lot of time here talking about Magic R&D, but, you know, just in my walk through Wizards, I was an Organized Play. I was on the brand team. I was on the technology team, you know, and then there's sales team, customer service, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of my time and effort is spent to make sure that the vision for each of these sets gets carried through so that, you know, when you're at the pre-release, your experience there, like, oh, if there is a pre-release kit, what's in that pre-release kit, aligns with all the way back to the early work that the vision designer does. So that's, I mean, of course, and then there's plenty more to it, but that's sort of like a brief encapsulation of, you know, one of my main functions.
Right. So one of the things that you and I interact all the time is a lot, I feel, of your job is I and my team establish a vision, and then you sort of carry it through the product to make sure that the vision happens. A good example might be Ikoria. I'm like, it's a monster set. And then once it's your job to make sure that everybody else knows it's a monster set, that the packaging looks like a monster set, that the marketing looks like a monster, you know, that everybody's working in the same direction. Because right. One of the kind of the whole point to a vision in the first place is it's about this, not about three other things. It's about this. Like I know, well, for example, Throne of Eldraine, you and I had a long talk because Throne Eldraine was fairy tales meets Camelot. That was kind of the pitch from the very beginning. And the thing I said to you is, while Camelot is cool, it's not, Magic has done it 8,000 times. You know what I'm saying? It's like, look, there's knights and, you know, like that's cool, but that's something Magic does all the time. And I'm like, you know, the fairy tale thing we don't do all the time. And I sort of explained to you that if you're going to sell the set, it's not that the set doesn't have the Camelot stuff, but that's not the exciting thing. Look, Magic has knights finally. It's not, no one gets, you know, no one's going to go, knights and Magic. But when you say, oh, look, it's Goldilocks, people, what? You know, it makes people stand up. And part of my job is to say to you, look, this is what's going to sort of sell the set. This is the part of the set that's going to be the exciting thing. And then your job is to make sure that everybody understands that. So, you know, if all the teams, like I said, just walking through what you've done, there's so many teams at Wizards. Part of the reason I've been doing these interviews is, like, look at all these different teams that exist. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one of the, you know, you mentioned Ikoria and being a monster set, and I think part of that like when I was working on the Godzilla box topper cards, right? It was like, hey, how come this is the right promotion to do with the set? It's like, well, it's the monster set. Godzilla is the king of the monsters. Hey, let's take a look at, you know, building a partnership. How do we want to successfully introduce these cards to Magic, right, in a way that complements the vision and complements the design, so that way players who are excited about that type of promotion can be excited about it, and players who want to focus on Mutate and Companion and all the other monster mechanics can still be excited about that, right? And so that's you know, the Godzilla promotion came along well after Vision Design had handed off, but sometimes those opportunities arise, and you know, it's my role to say, hey, that doesn't fit within the vision of the set. Let's stay away from that.
Yeah, the other thing that people may not realize is there's a lot of things that surround a set. You know, like nowadays, for example, sometimes we have Commander product tied to a set, or we might have, or even just in any one set, you know, for example, the collector pack. Like, there's a lot of components that happen in a set now. When I think of you right now, these days, I'll be writing some article and I'm messaging you going, okay, what's in this? What's in that? What, you know, and making sure I have everything straight so that I can communicate it. And you have to keep track of all that stuff.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I both have to keep track of the collector booster information, and I have to be, working with the internal teams on planning it out, making sure that our print vendors have a good idea of it, making sure that our internal operations people have a full understanding of, hey, this is what this collector booster represents. Because a lot of what booster fun is, you know, we're trying to have fun with it. We're trying to go to these fun, amazing art styles and introduce these cards in a fun way. That means that there's just variation between what we did with Ikoria and did with Eldraine and, you know, Theros Beyond Death. Like, there's a little bit less of that typical cadence, and we're just introducing more variation because for each set, we want to be representing that set as well as possible.
And you, nowadays, you do a lot of the what we call premier sets, the non-core premier sets is what you tend to work on, right?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, of sets that have been released, Throne of Eldraine, Ikoria, Lair of Behemoth, Zendikar Rising, which I know... I think you've already talked about once this goes live. Those are some sets, as well as Double Masters. So those are sets just coming out here in, you know, 2019 and in this year, 2020, that I've been the lead for.
Yeah. Like I said, one of the things that I think when I tell stories about, like, I came up with the card and the people are like, and it got made or something, you know, like I had an idea for a set and it got made. They miss the hundreds of people working on it, you know, and not obviously R&D is part of it, but as you're talking about, there's just so many different sections that all have to come together. It is not like I talk a lot about getting R&D on board, then you have to get everybody else on board, which is a huge number of teams.
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the things that's, you know, having gone from being a Magic designer to now a principal product designer for Magic, one of the things that's very clear is no matter how many times I've thought, oh, and now I've communicated all of the details, right? Now I've thought of everything. Basically, as soon as I make a post or a communication, I get back, you know, 5 poignant questions from the team that weren't in that because there are so many details. I think that I could likely come on and do a half hour talk about how we changed, how we handle collector numbers in the bottom text of the card with Eldraine, right? And so it's just like, oh, here it is. Here's a number that's on the card that you always see and look at. And like somebody, and in fact, lots of somebodies are out there being like, all right, how are collector numbers being handled for this set? How do we want to order these, et cetera? You know, what are the rules behind them?
Yeah, then the interesting thing about, like, collector numbers is a great example. I'll bet the average player doesn't think, they know they exist and they use them, but I don't think people think the amount of work hours that go into collector numbers. Like, if you ask the average player, they go, well, how hard is it? And they have no idea. They have no idea the amount of hours.
Yes, they have Yeah, and rightfully so, because, I mean, from our standpoint, it's like, oh, when you open a pack and when you're playing a game of Magic, we want you focused on the fun, right? Yeah. And if you're looking down at the footer, the footer, and seeing, oh, I wonder why this card is 268/270, right? Then we haven't done our job. I want you focusing on, oh, this is a great Magic card. You know, look at this cool play I made. This is the deck I want to build. Those are the things that, you know, that's why we all play Magic.
Yeah, and when you look at a Magic card, it's a great thing. Just take a normal Magic card and look at it, and every aspect of that card, no matter what part you look at, some team has spent a lot more time than you could possibly imagine on making sure that is what it needs to be. Whether it's the name, the mana cost, the art, the card type, the collector number, the legal text, you know, the flavor text. Like, it's every piece of the card. There's a lot that goes on to every single piece, and it is definitely. Anyway, it's. I'm hoping a lot of these interviews get people to see that of all the people that are working on all these different things. So.
Yeah. No, it's. I'm glad you're doing them. Because I think that, you know, in a podcast, it is a really fun way to sort of open people's eyes. I mean, I remember back, like, your original question was talking about, oh, you know, how did you start at Wizards? Like, people now ask me the question, like, oh, did you always know you were going to be a game designer? Like, is that something that when you were growing up you wanted to be? I was like, I didn't even realize that was a possibility. Like, it wasn't even in my mind space that, like, you know, when I'm playing, you know, Axis and Allies with my dad, or playing Risk with my cousin, that, like, somebody makes this game. And now, of course, even, you know, with those games too, all of these details of how this box of components gets onto a shelf and sold to me, I have such a greater understanding of it. But, you know, as a kid, it wasn't like, oh yeah, that'll be my career. But here we are, and now it is. And it's
yeah, awesome. It's funny now when I open a game and I play a brand new game, how I'll marvel at components sometimes. Like, wow, they really handle these components well.
Right. Like, oh, look at these molds. My goodness.
So, anyway, it's fun. It's kind of funny how, my olden days when I used to be a writer, like, I'd go to a movie or something, and you can see the structure when you understand it. And it's interesting how when you get to know something, you can't not see the behind-the-scenes stuff, because that's what you do all the time. So,
yeah, well, and that's how, I mean, to me, it's one of the great ways that I know that I'm really, you know, still in love with Magic and into the game is, like, when I play, right, like, yes, if I stop and think about it, I'll be like, oh, here's this aspect that sort of is unlocked. But typically, I'm just in the game, I'm just having fun, right? I'm thinking about what my next play is, right? I'm not
which is attacking, I believe.
Yeah, which is, it's always attacking, yes. Always attack. That's a good rule of thumb.
Okay, so I'm approaching my desk now, so we need to wrap this up. So any last thoughts before I get to work?
Any last thoughts? Well, I think to me, man, I didn't know about this. You know, I'm excited for Zendikar Rising. It's gonna be so much fun. I mean, every time that we go and we revisit a world that I worked on, you know, originally, right? Like you mentioned us working on original Zendikar together. There's always just that thrill of like, oh, where is this world going to go next? Where is this plane going to go next? I'm really excited about that upcoming release. I don't know.
By the way, I get a great joy every time we do another Zendikar set, just because the number of years that people just didn't believe we would ever do it. So anyway,
right? Yeah, no, I mean that's exactly what, you know, I'm going for. Of like, oh, you know, if we do a set with reprints, like I super love when we're doing a set with reprints, and I'm like, oh, I made this card, like. I can go back and check my files and, you know, talk about the design of it. You know, just seeing reprints, seeing us revisit places in that way. That's so much fun. And of course, too, I mean, since we mentioned Future Sight, I super love when a card from Future Sight gets introduced into Magic. That's always it's always fun because, you know, especially now, so many years after Future Sight's release, like, you know, the... the stars really need to align now for one of those future site cards to happen. Not relating that to Zendikar Rising at all. I'm just talking about that in general.
Well, thank you, Mike. So I see my desk. So we all know what that means. I mean, this is the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. So thanks, Mike, for joining us.
Thanks, Mark, for having me.
And anyway, guys, I will see you next time. Bye-bye.